So good afternoon, everybody. We are missing one professor in our triple professor session this week, but I think we'll get going because I can tell everybody's in anticipation and ready to kick off. Thank you very much for joining us today. My name is Tara Joseph. I'm a journalist with Reuters and vice president of the FCC this year. An unusual event for us to have an afternoon session, but of course, the Chinese economy and what medicine is needed is such a key topic for everyone involved this year that we really wanted to give it its due respect. So what we'll do in terms of format today is have all of our guest speakers give introductory remarks of about 5 to 8 minutes, and then we will open it up for questions and answers and hopefully a really good discussion, just to let everyone know everything here is on the record today as well. So without further ado, let me please introduce our guests. We have Professor Huang, who's with the MIT Sloan School of Management based in Boston. We have Professor Liu, who is the Dean of the School of Management at Fudan University, and Professor Zhu, who is also a Dean at Fudan University. Professor Huan is going to start by speaking for the need for the role of government to change in order for the economy in China to transition. From Professor Liu, we'll hear about whether innovation is crucial in China for the economy to really take off again. And Professor Zhu will speak about China's deepening reform and liberalization. So, Professor Huang, if you would kick it off, if you'd come up to the podium, that would be fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you, Tara. Very happy to be invited to FCC to have this panel discussion. Very sorry that one professor is missing. He may be the second most important professor. The most important professor is Professor Liu, and I'm the least important professor. So I apologize for missing that. So Tara asked me to just give a few comments about what medicine is needed for Chinese economy next, and specifically what the role of the government would be in providing that medicine. I think since the FCC chose the framing of the topic as medicine, the first principle in medicine is to do no harm. My concern is that every time we talk about the role of the government, the principle of doing no harm is not as well understood as the principle of providing action, or at least of being perceived as providing actions, right? So if you think about 2008, the huge stimulus program, which I believe laid down the foundation for some of the issues that we have to grapple with today, you know, that was really perceived as when the economy is slowing down, the government naturally is in the position of doing lots of things. Usually we don't think about the role of the government should be, under certain situations, should be doing less rather than doing more. Specifically, I believe that the Chinese government should do less in one specific area. And that has to do with, this is a directional change and maybe ideological change, which I think is the reason why it is very difficult to do. So if you think about the stimulus program and for the last 20 years, how the Chinese economy has grown, it is based on the principle that the government provides financing, the organizational and logistic arrangements for building infrastructures and building high-speed railways and building industrial parks, right? So this is a proactive philosophy of the role of the government. Many foreign business people have very high opinion of this particular approach, which is known as state capitalism, right? State capitalism. State capitalism was actually invented by Nikolai Bukharin in the early days of the Soviet Union. And he debated with Lenin about the need to preserve the private sector. But on top of that, the government should occupy what is known as a commanding heights, banking, steel, aluminum, transportation, these are commanding heights of the economy. Soviet Union settled that debate by executing him, so that was never carried out. That was actually a very common way of settling academic, intellectual debates in the Soviet Union. Arguably, China today has a Bukharian model of economic growth. If you look at Chinese economy today, downstream is mostly private sector, right? Upstream is state sector, right? Think about steel industry, state sector. Think about textile industry, private sector. Manufacturing, mostly private sector. Service, except for the small retail service sector, banking, telecom, state sector, right? This is a classic definition of state capitalism. And state capitalism in China also is not just about financing, it's also about organization, right? How do you kick out the rural households who have a house in front of a parcel of land that you want to build a road over, right? So that you use the power, the eminent domain power of the government to do that. Many foreign business people say this is tremendous, look at the Chinese growth and all of that. The thing that they don't know or don't bother to know is the fact that for every penny saved for business operating in China, it is one penny less in terms of income to the households, right? So if I take over Tara's house, below market price, then as a business, I enjoy the difference between the actual price and the market price, right? I don't have to pay for the market price. My business costs are low, but her income is also low as a result, right? So that subtle effect on household income is something that I believe that we should pay more attention to rather than less attention to now. The reason I say this is fairly straightforward. The reason why the Chinese consumption, household consumption, not total consumption, as a share of the GDP is not very high, it's 35%, and it has not increased since 2008, despite the explicit efforts by the government. The reason why that share is not high is not because of high savings rate, right? So there's, again, a mistake made by journalists, and if I may say so, and academics, that the reason why the Chinese consumption is not catching up with the GDP is because of high savings rate. If you look at the private savings rate of the Chinese, it's comparable to savings rate in India, in other developing countries, right? So the Chinese savings rate is high because the government savings rate is high. Corporate savings is high and rising. The household saving is roughly along the international norm. So that's not really where the action is. Thinking about the savings rate is not where the action is because it's already at the appropriate level. Improving social security provision, healthcare, education, old age pension is something that the government believes and the IMF also believes to be the reason that would motivate the Chinese to consume. Again, this is based on a mistake. The mistake, it's absolutely good in and of itself to improve the supply of social services, right? Just for reasons, not for macroeconomic rebalancing reasons, just for the reasons that these are the good things to do. But for macroeconomic rebalance reason, this is the wrong thing to do, or this is the irrelevant thing to do. It is not the case that in India, a country that has a household consumption GDP ratio about 65%, it's not the case that India has a very advanced social security system. That's not really the reason. The reason why India, which has similar household savings rate as compared with Chinese household savings rate, the reason why Indians seem to be consuming more out of each dollar of the GDP is because in India, the household income growth is comparable to the GDP growth. That's the difference between China and India. India has a lower GDP growth rate, but their household personal income, right, the take-home pay, right? So I work for MIT, so each week, hopefully, I get paid. But I don't get paid in GDP. I get paid by a check, by cash, right? So we need to, most people just look at GDP. I have developed a habit of looking away from GDP. You need to look at the take-home pay. What's happening to that take-home pay? Is the take-home pay growth comparable to GDP growth or not comparable to GDP growth, right? In China, in the last 20 years, the take-home pay has lagged behind the GDP growth rate. That's the reason why the consumption, household consumption, relative to GDP is not high, right? So then what medicine do we need? If you treat this as an illness, as an economic illness, not as a physical illness, although low income growth has resulted in physical illnesses, but that's a separate issue. You treat this as an economic disease, the kind of medicine you need is for the government to play a smaller role in the economy, not to force people to sell their land, right? To stand by and let the market make that determination. And the other thing that I believe the other medicine that is needed is to have not just economic mobility in China, but also social mobility across different regions, right? So what I mean by economic mobility vis-a-vis social mobility, it is absolutely the case that the Chinese manufacturing miracle is created by the rural migrant workers. In China, you migrate for economic reasons, right? But you leave your households behind, you leave your grandparents and parents behind, and your children behind. I think it's time for China to think about seriously abolishing the hukou system, which has restricted the social mobility across different regions. The social mobility is actually the mechanism to equalize the income gains in the developed regions vis-a-vis the income gains in the developing regions, right? So the poorest people want to leave, right? When the poorest people want to leave, the per capita income of the exporting region rises, right? Because the poorest people want to leave, the places that they go to, the average income actually drops. That's actually the way to equalize income distribution. So I believe that these are the medicines. These are not the full plate of the medicines, but I think the medicine that we shouldn't think as the first principle to apply is the medicine that is usually regarded as the first principle, which is to get a lot of credit into the economy, huge stimulus program, build airports and build highways. I believe that has played a positive role in the past, but increasingly the relative benefits of doing more of that vis-a-vis the cost of allowing the market to do the determination, that ratio is declining rather than rising. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor. So we have one professor left, as we have a mysterious missing figure. Professor Liu, please could you come to the podium? We're going to hear about innovation and why it's crucial.
Thank you, Talon. And when I got this question, is innovation the any kind of recipe for the future development of Chinese economy or not? Definitely, it's true. It is. Actually, when we review the last 30 years economic development in China, we have a very also basic conclusion. It's not only because of the reform policy set by government, I mean the push from government top down, but also it's because of the entrepreneurship to make change from the bottom up. When we see, you know, state-owned companies still play a very important role in the Chinese economy, but also the private sector now is much, much more important than 30 years ago. The first generation or second generation entrepreneurs in China already are very actively playing their role in all the different sectors in Chinese economy. We believe in the future, such a partner should be becoming more and more important, not only because of the portion of the whole GDP, but also they offer such a kind of the momentum, such a resources, and also wisdom to facilitate the economy to develop further. And also, when we reviewed in the last 30 years, when we look at the private sector, we believe why the private sector is so, you know, becoming more and more important, though, so powerful, because, you know, the first generation or second generation Chinese entrepreneurs are brave and also smart enough. When we say they are brave, you know, because they would like to do something they are not allowed to do. They would like to take the risk. And also, we say they are smart because they can see something the others cannot see. You know, they really grasp the opportunities in the market. They know how to develop their own social capital to connect it to the public sector or government agency to exploit the resources which traditionally, you know, owned or held by the government. So they can leverage such resources to their private sector. So when we see today all successful stories, but behind them, you should believe much, much more actually already failed. So they do a lot of experimenting, you know, jobs. You know, some, I'm not sure, 10% or 15% finally can survive and also can really have very successful business. But when we review such a process, we could see, you know, in general, they can do a lot of innovation about their business model. No matter they duplicate such a business model from Western, you know, side, you know, especially online business, you could see we in China we have a lot of duplication. But in the local market also we could see a lot of innovative business models, which actually foreign experts, business people, scholars cannot fully understand. We can read, you know, their, if they are listed companies, read their, you know, annual reports, and a lot of people believe, you know, they such information, if you because the such information is well structured by the such a CFA or CPA, you know, which actually is very similar to the format of annual report of Western listed companies. But however, behind that, a lot of the real recipe for such a success is quite different. They really can leverage their social capital to do some things which actually foreign companies who are based in China or who invest in China cannot understand or cannot do. So they really innovate their business models. That's why they can really build up their comparative advantage compared to the state-owned and also foreign invest companies. So that's the very key reason for the success of the private sector in the last at least, you know, 15 years or 20 years. So looking to the future, I still believe, you know, innovation is the only way, only recipe, not medicine, because medicine is harmful, right? Recipe is not harmful for when we cook such a Cantonese, you know, soup or food. It's still the only way, only solution to the future sustainable growth of Chinese economy. That's not only my belief, but also the belief of many economists or experts in China. But in the future, we cannot rely on only, you know, one innovation. That's a business model innovation. We have to combine the business model innovation with the real technological innovation, which we didn't have during the last 30 years, or we nearly didn't have. No, we have several cases, you know, very unique cases like Huawei, or probably one or two more. But most, you know, the successful stories not about the technological innovation, only about business model innovation. But in the future, how we can survive, how we can compete with more and more, you know, technological innovation, which actually offer, which are pursued by the foreign companies, we also have to rely on our own innovation. That's about, you know, the real risky investment. Why we didn't have such an innovation at a micro level or business level? Because state-owned companies didn't have such a motivation to invest for the uncertain result of tech R&D, right? they have to report to the government, political bureau, their achievement. Their achievement is not about such innovation, progress. It's about, their short-term return on the investment on assets. That's their criteria of the evaluation. So for the foreign invest company, they also don't care a lot about innovation for the local market. They just have to do some applied research for leverage their headquarters technology or kind of the recipe or patents for the Chinese market. They do some applied research, such as applied innovation. So it's not real. It's not a big portion of their total investment in China. We probably have one or two exceptions, but mainly, it's not about innovation. The private sector also didn't care because it's easy for them to make fast money when they rely on the larger scale, right? If they can, easily get resources, cheaply, they just try to expand their size as soon as possible, and then they also rely on export. As most of the private sector could be successful because they have a large export. And when the international market, American European market, is expanding during the last 15 years, and such a business model also could survive and feasible. So they rely such a bigger and a bigger scale, and also the cost could be lower. Even their price of the export also is lower, but still they can make nice profit, and that's the way they could grow their business. But such a model actually is the end. So what we can do for the future? So that's the question most not only the private sector ask themselves, but also for the SOE now review their personal past and also now think about the future ahead. That's a real challenge. So how we can start our innovation journey in China, which we didn't have in our genome or in our history? Basically, I think, firstly, the government should take the lead for such an innovation process. Why? Because, in China, it's still not free economy. It's still half free economy, half centralized economy. It's not so simple. It's a very complex, mixed, economic structure. You cannot either say, such a consumer goods, industry already are free economy. I cannot say yes. Why? As long as there are SOE are involved, they are not pure free economy. Because SOE not only follow the market signal, but also they follow the instruction of the government. So it's a really complex economic structure in China. So if government doesn't want to believe innovation is the future, I don't think we can really have the future in China. So the government should signal the very clear signal that send out such a signal that we have to rely on innovation. So now, yes, many governments, at the professional level, city level, set up a lot of VC, they invest in some new technology, some new industry, and the central government also has developed a lot of policies to lead such an innovation. It's very good, because Chinese people, no matter they as consumers or the business people, they always would like to believe it's right. We have to follow. It's a mainstream of the future. So such a policy development is also the key or critical for the whole country to work together. Secondly, government also should allocate resources very nicely or very effectively on the innovation. Now, what kind of the industry they have to support? What kind of the new technology they should explore? We cannot either rely on the business itself, because the business, especially the private business, don't want to take them the big risk. So real innovation, especially we could see military industry in China now very innovation driven, because the security system relies on that. So we have to invest huge money in the innovation. Such a kind of the outputs also can be leveraged to the, you know, the civil use. We believe, you know, if the whole business people can believe it's the real decision made by the government, then the private sector also will follow and also will want to invest aggressively in the new technology. And further, when we talk about the innovation of government, we believe the government system also should be changed with such an innovation mindset. I mean, not only mean the institutional system should be innovated, but also the whole macro management system, I mean, the micro, economic management system should be changed also. But so far, even the central government already set 60 goals for the future development. But however, those 60 goals cannot be actualized without the real innovation of the institutional system change. So that's why from private sector people, they could not have the full confidence of the Chinese future. Why? Because after already 2 years, the real action, most of the real actions have not been taken. Where people still wait to see what will happen for next couple of years. Still, many private sector believes central government still have too many things to do. They still focus on the anti-bribery, activities. They cannot really develop the good, policies or strategies for the future economic development. So then the private sector also doesn't want to invest in the innovation of technology. They still try to leverage their current resources to do some innovative business model. So that's why the whole pace of further reform is held, it's not by the private, it's by the government. Secondly, innovation also should be the real philosophy or mindset of the business people of the SOE and the POE. SOE, we could see, the government has a very clear policy of the SOE change, but we could not see the concrete content of such a policy. It's just rough guidance. It's just very principled ideas. So then SOE say, okay, it's good, but we don't know how to do. But then the private sector also don't want to take the lead, because it's very risky. So they also now wait for the action of the SOE. If SOE wanted to do something, it's really good, it's a good reference for the POE to follow. So I think, if all the people believe, if they would like to take the pilot, step to do something risky for now, but it's for long run, probably it's a really good return or high return on such a risky action. Probably we could see, that it's another round of the innovation of the business models and also on the technological investment. So that's a second innovation. Innovation should be the culture, should be the philosophy of the business community, but now it's not well developed. Last but not least, I believe, why the whole Chinese society cannot have such a good culture of innovation because of the educational system, because so far the education system is very centralized, and the central government, the government senior officials believes we have to offer a fair, equal educational opportunities for everyone, but it's not fair, really, for the efficiency and also for the innovation. Why I say that? Because everyone wants to compete with others to enter into the good universities, not the university. It's now easier, much easier to enter into the university or college, but it's much more difficult to enter into the best universities in China, which means they have to work very hard from the primary school the middle school and through the high school, then they can, you know, go through the very fierce competition to be admitted, you know, by the Fudan or the other Tsinghua universities in China. But in China, in mainland China, we only have one or two or three best universities, Tsinghua, Beida, Fudan. I'm not sure which one is the fourth one. But in the United States, there are so many, 30, 50, you know, very good universities, you know, equally, and I mean equal quality, the same as the Fudan or Beida Tsinghua. So then the kids really don't develop their any personal interest. They are not curious about anything they don't know. They just focus on the study, the textbooks. That's very harmful for the culture or spirit of innovation. When the students enter into university or college, they start thinking of what kind of future they have. But it's too late. Even they start thinking of that, but still they haven't, you know, opportunity or chances to develop such a picture of their future career. No one give them the help. So that's why, you know, the overall science, engineering, you know, are much less advanced than what is necessary. We have so many talents, you know, very intelligent people, working, hard-working people, but still we cannot compete with the most advanced, you know, technology-driven countries like United States, even Britain. Why? You know, education. So we have to change the education system. Otherwise, we also will lose the young kids. The kids, you know, now go to abroad, go to the United States, go to Europe for education. Not only because, you know, their families would like them to go abroad and transfer the asset, the family asset, you know, the financial asset, but also they believe, you know, the Western, you know, system in some way is much better than the Chinese, you know, education system. And then, you know, these smart kids, you know, the good, you know, very well-educated kids, very intelligent kids, you know, with the, such a family, very strong financial support, you know, goes to foreign countries. It's a real kind of a loss of the Chinese, you know, asset for the future development. So if we cannot change the whole educational concept and system, we also cannot have the future. So that's my, you know, the very basic points. Already I talked too much, you know. So I think, you know, we still have the hope, you know. That's why I'm here. And also I believe, you know, most of Chinese educated people, no matter they work for the government or work for the university or for the business, already have such a consensus. But how we can have the first, you know, the kickoff or the start, you know, how we can start. I think, you know, it's easier for the government to start rolling the ball, not for the private, you know, sector, you know, the micro level to rolling the ball. So that's my points. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Lots of food for thought there. I'll just kick it off with one question, and then I hope everyone will get involved. Professor Huang, I wanted to start with you and this idea that China needs to move further away from being a state economy. My question is, are we seeing actual signs of that? Do you see huge progress or very little progress? And also, do you think there is a good model out there already that China can look at? Is it the American model, the Singapore model? Is there already a working model that you think would fit China quite well?
Okay. So two questions. One is there evidence that the country is moving in that direction? And secondly, if it were to move in that direction, what model it should look at? I think the way to answer the second question is to answer the first question. The evidence is fairly few that the country is moving in that direction. It's probably moving in the other direction. Typically, when the growth slows down, you see a bigger hand of the government. And some of that is for entirely legitimate reasons, right? So if you jumpstart the economy, stimulate the economy, then you actually need the bigger hand of the government in doing that. And this is the debate that has been going on in the United States between those who argue that American government should do more, and others, mostly on the Republican side, who say that the government should do less. You can actually have the same framework applied to the United States, arguing for more actions of the government, and you can use exactly the same framework for China, arguing for less government role, exactly the same analytical framework. The reason why you need to do more in the United States, and this is the famous idea by Keynes, when he said that the reason why you can dig a hole and then fill it up, why that's good for economic growth, the reason why that's good for economic growth is that private sector doesn't have the confidence. So essentially you create this psychological fiction for the private sector to believe, actually there's something going on, so let me invest, right? And once you invest, I begin to invest, and we solve that collective action problem that way. In China, the situation is exactly the opposite. The private sector has this huge pent-up demand for making investments. The private sector wants to invest. The private sector wants to borrow from the banking system. The private sector wants to raise the capital through the capital market. The private sector wants to expand, right? So there's no shortage of the animal spirit on the part of the private sector in China. Essentially, when you have a government still in that scenario playing a bigger role, you are standing in the way of the private sector development rather than facilitating the private sector. So I often hear the argument, oh, somehow that China is doing the right thing and U.S. is doing the wrong thing, which is that U.S. is not stimulating the economy and China is stimulating the economy in the right way. You actually heard that argument more, say, 5 years ago, 4 years ago than today. If you read Tom Friedman, I guess the friend of many people here, he is so gaga about the stimulus program. And let's just bear in mind that the Chinese stimulus program is bigger than the U.S. stimulus program, both in absolute measure and relative measure. This is remarkable, right? So U.S. was on the verge of financial collapse and recession, and China was still growing, fairly healthily. It is an economy that actually doesn't need a stimulus program. It is an economy that needs rechanneling the resources. I very much agree with Professor Liu about the importance of the private sector. I think this is the good thing about China, and this is one difference that I see in China vis-a-vis other developing countries. In China, the private sector wants to grow even if you put up a lot of low barriers in front of them. In other countries, the private sector doesn't even want to grow. Even if you put a tank behind them, they still don't want to move, right? So in the situation where the private sector doesn't want to move, I agree with Professor Liu there. What he said is that the government needs to take the first step so that the private sector has the confidence. I think in China, the private sector is already way ahead in terms of their economic development and potentials. So I worry more, it is not the case that I'm not a Republican person at all, and I believe by and large Republican Party is absolutely wrong on almost everything. And wrong about many other things.
You're first started here at the FCC.
Yeah. And they're more wrong about things they haven't even have a view on. But that's not the issue. The issue is for China, we're faced with a it's not an ideological argument for less government. It is a pragmatic, practical argument for less government. It has to do with rechanneling, reallocating resources. In terms of the model, I actually think that China itself holds up a model, and I wrote a book about this. If you go back to China in the 1980s, this is a country that was growing GDP, very, very healthy GDP growth rate, and very healthy private household income growth rate. The rural household income growth rate was faster than the GDP growth rate. And there's a myth out there that says something to the effect that Chinese development is all about economic reforms, not about political reforms. There were a lot of political reforms in the 1980s. It is amazing how forgetful people are about things that only happened more than 20 years ago. There were a lot of explicit political reforms in the 1980s. We're actually doing a big data project on this and systematically estimating the how diverse the political views were in the 1980s. The economic reforms happened on the basis of some political reforms, right? So the two things actually go together rather than against each other. There's a new thing, that idea emerged in the 1980s, which is known as new authoritarianism. The view is that you need a strong leader to push for reforms. If you look at the evidence carefully, actually this is true both in China and India, when there is debate at the highest level of the government, when there's a healthy debate, healthy diversity of points of views, reforms happen the fastest. Right? When there's one person in charge deciding on everything, reforms don't happen. Right? I agree that the current leadership has a very detailed blueprint of the reform plan announced in November 2013. But if you look at the history of Chinese reforms, the most radical reforms tend to happen when the central leadership has a very general plan, directional plan, rather than a detailed blueprint. The reason is very simple. In China, almost every other person is a reformer. So the demand for reforms is actually ahead of the supply of the reforms. So if you just announce some general principles about flexibility, the reforms are going to happen on their own. Right? This is exactly what happened in rural China in the late 1970s and early 1980s. Deng Xiaoping didn't say, oh, let's adopt the household responsibility system. Actually, he didn't say that at all. He actually said in 1986 explicitly that lots of these successes in the countryside happened despite our ignorance. He said we shouldn't take credit for this, right? What he did, and this is the greatest thing about Deng, what he did was he allowed experimentation and flexibility. And then the lower level people, including the rural population, got things right. This is what I don't see in today's China. And I believe that we don't need to look further in terms of the model. By the way, Singapore, I don't think is the right model. I'd be happy to elaborate on that. Other than the obvious reasons, there are also other reasons, but I'll be happy to come back to that if there's interest. US, I think the political system is dysfunctional. I mean, there's no question about it. So even if you are in supportive of democracy, you wouldn't want to wish the US political system on China. I mean, just look at Donald Trump, right? So it's any system that has a Donald Trump, by definition, is a failure of politics.
Well, I don't want to spend too much time on Donald Trump, but he was quite innovative, right? Or he was a very strong businessman. So what type of system do you think we need to be more innovative? Are we going through the right process now in China? Or are we sliding backwards?
First, you know, I totally agree to Professor Huang that, you know, why we could have a good reform, you know, no matter, you know, we don't reveal the every detail, you know, the strategy or kind of the policy of the past 30 years, but in general, we believe, you know, the reform is very successful, extremely successful. Otherwise, we cannot have such a successful, you know, economy. But, you know, the economic reform actually was really facilitated by the political reform. So it's a very key point. For the future, the same.
But it's not me to talk about political reform.
Do you think we're going backwards, though, in terms of being an innovative culture for China?
Yeah. First, you know, why I said, you know, the central government also should make change of the institutional system, because if you would like to take action to restructure yourself, then it's quite a strong signal. It's the action is much more important than what you say, right? If you really would like to reform yourself, then how, you know, people would like to believe you really believe in the reform or innovation. So the same, if really, you know, the central only, you know, state-owned companies could also start the real investment, the you know, on the technology development, then the all, you know, the foreign invest companies, private companies also believe, you know, you really believe in such a innovation. Actually, so far, you cannot imagine, according to the official statistics, the percentage of the R&D, we call it expenses, you know, of the total revenue. Let me see. The highest portion is still the foreign invest companies, then the state-owned companies, then the private companies. Private companies only invest probably less than 2%, even 1.5% of their total revenue in the R&D. And the SOE just 4-5%. Foreign investment companies, even not such a real R&D project, but, you know, they spend more than 8%, even 10% of their revenue for the R&D. So, but if this is not real, you know, it's not the real concrete, you know, innovation. So if the state-owned companies don't want to spend the money on the R&D, on the innovation, why the private would like to take the risk, right? They believe, you know, you are not only the big companies, you're the leading companies in the industry, but also you are responsible for the whole, you know, country's innovation, because you're state-owned. You have such a, you know, responsibility to do that. So that's why I think, you know, the first push should be given by the central government to change your political system, to change your economic system, and also to change the mindset and also the real strategy of the corporate governance of the state-owned companies. So that's you know, what we have to expect, or we have to require the central government to do. You know, so that's why I mentioned, you know, such a institutional system change. Is the key. It's really critical for the launch of the innovation process.
Thank you. I'd like to open it up to the floor for questions. Please raise your hand if you want to give us your organization or association. That would be great. We'll start right over here. Do you want to stand up? I'm not sure if we have a microphone, so if you could speak loudly. Ah, we do have a microphone coming right over there. Thanks.
City University. This is for Professor Liu about your comments about...
We'll just lift the microphones. Yeah.
Oh.
Right, there
closer,
we go.
Yes.
Thank your you. Comments about the Fantastic. Education system, if I understood them. In the United States, there's been a movement to more standardization at the levels below university. And I wonder if you think that will eventually result in damaging the ability of the United States to create innovations.
I don't have, you know, a direct observation of the education system in the United States, and also I probably is not the right person to talk about that. But, you know, in general. I also would like to say, you know, Chinese education system has also some advantages. Yes, it's a very good training and for the kids, you know, through the whole system, right? Everyone, you know, especially in the cities, you know, can get, you know, equal educational opportunities. They are very serious, you know, trained for the very fundamental knowledge. You know, it's good preparation for them to take the more advanced education in the college, in the advanced programs in the universities. So that's why we China is becoming the pipeline of the talents to the United States. So so in general, I think, you know, the quality is good. But my point is, you know, but at the same time, we could not explore the young people's curiosity to, you know, from very beginning to think about what kind of career they have to pursue, and also what kind of the biggest potential they can explore by themselves through the education system. In the United States, you know, I know basically private schools have a very different philosophies and different systems or resources, you know, compared to public schools. So their problems, you know, should be solved by them, by themselves. But in general, their private school systems still are quite good, but rely on, you know, the private revenue, I mean, through the all the wealthy families. When I visit some universities, labs, in the labs, of course, it's interesting, you know, advisor, professor, has his team, you know, to do some projects. He has 10, even more, you know, the PhD students working for him, right? Among these 10, usually 5 from China, 1 or 2 from India, another 1 from United States itself, and the 2 or 3 from other countries, from Mexico, from Europe. Chinese students always can be top 5, you know, number 2, number 5, number 6, you know, good students. And India, usually number 3 or number 1. But in United States, you know, the American students usually, I believe 9 of the 10 chances are the number 1 guy. Why? Because he has developed such an interest from a very early stage, from 7 years old, from 8 years old. So when I talk about innovation, I mean, you know, such a the real innovation, why it still is developed by, you know, offered by the United States? Because on the top of the top people, such a the smartest people still are educated by the United States through its education system. That's my point.
But
so innovators, I don't want to compare generally, you know, the systems, you know.
I mean, innovators, and if we think of some of the most famous in the United States, Steve Jobs and Apple, I mean, those are people who break the mold, who tend to break the rules. Can that really happen in China?
It's stunning. To be frank, it's starting because, you know, we could see some kids, you know, even they could not go through the or survive through such a very competitive, you know, education process. They are GPA not high enough, but they want to be different. You know, in my school, same, the college students, MBA students, they don't care about too much about, you know, their credits or the GPA. They really care about, you know, what kind of the things they can do differently compared to other peers. So such a philosophy, such a culture is now booming, but it's a little bit late because, you know, it's why? When the students in the college, in any program, think of their innovation, it's not about technology, usually it's about a business model. So now I encourage my students, my school students, the business school, right, to work with their peers in the engineering, from the science, you know, but still, fortunately, China always has such a brilliant, you know, talents. You know, they started earlier. I mean, they started exploring their own interests later, you know, but they catch up very quickly. So when they enter into college, you know, they don't want to follow the traditional system. You know, they want to explore something new. They would like to work with the peers from different disciplines. Then probably the chance actually is happening. So around our Fudan campus, we have a lot of incubators, you know, around the campus. I visited them, you know, once a while. I could see some students, some graduates from the university, not from my school, from other schools also, work together as a group in such an incubating office. When I talked to them, now roughly 30% is about innovation of technology. They have their own recipe of technology, not only just a new concept of business model. So that's the difference compared to the first generation or second generation. When I say the current generation, probably the third generation entrepreneurs, they represent well-educated people with the new concept of the technology and also the global perspectives. They are different from the first generation, late 1980s or early 1990s. Second generation, they start their business usually in after middle of 1990s or in the early 21st century. But now, this generation, you know, their background is totally different.
More questions. We'll go to the back row and then move our way up.
Thank you. I actually come from a think tank in Admiralty, but the name is so small, probably was mentioning.
So you're an innovator.
Not actually, but we are kind of analyzing central government's policies and incentives as well as reasons behind each policy. So I actually do have a very keen question for Professor Huang. Do you think the central government has a real serious concern about its both legitimacy as well as its source of power? So it tends to be very wary of releasing the animal spirit of private sector because it does not know how to control what would happen thereafter. And as well as, the problem of control, as well as it's not that confident that it will have, it will still be relevant if it does release, because what we see in the 1980s, kind of this happened. The government kind of sidelined and not central government, how to say that. Governments in provincial or even city level, they tend to take the initiative of opening up, and something tends to go wrong in the sense of central government's officials' eyes. They see policies going a variety of directions, and people started to ask tricky questions regarding political reforms, and that's why they took the break and China went into a different direction. Do you see this serves like a reason why central government is resistant to such an idea of opening up more? And
I think there's something to that. In the past, there was a perception that there's a trade-off between growth and control. And in the 1980s, I think the prevailing ideology was that we were willing to give up on control in exchange for growth. And the growth happened, and we all know how that decade ended. And then I think the subsequent generations of leadership settled upon a new formula. And this time, the formula is growth and control. Right? So rather than growth vis-a-vis control. And that has worked. I mean, let's be very, very honest about this. The GDP growth in the 1990s and 2000s has been very fast. And mostly because of government-funded, government-organized investments. Also, the development of the private sector, but mostly on the margin. And as subcontractors of the state sector. My point is that this formula is, I think, coming to an end. And the country probably has to face, again, this dilemma between trading off more growth vis-a-vis gaining or losing more control. I don't know whether or not there is a central government view on this, because I Cambridge, Massachusetts is very far away from that. All I can say is that to the extent that you think about issues that way, that provides a framework for you to think about issues that way. And I believe that that question that has been shoved aside for the last 20 years is once again resurfacing, and the growth is slowing down. We can debate about how much and all of that. But I think the evidence is very, very strong that even with private entrepreneurship, innovation, technology, even in the best case scenario, it is hard to imagine that the growth is going to come back to 10% a year and things like that. So the reason is actually quite simple, and we can actually quantify that. In the past 30 years, the contributions of the productivity growth to the Chinese GDP growth is about 30%. So 10%, say, growing every year, 3% of that is productivity. And the productivity, 60% of the 30% is mostly industrialization, reallocating the rural labor to the industry. And that's a huge reallocation, as we know, right? So hundreds of millions of people. So that big movement of people gives you about 60% of the 30%, which is about 1.8% of the 10% of GDP growth. 1.8, I mean, this huge, right? The rest is maybe management reforms and policy reforms and opening up to the rest of the world. Technology probably has contributed zero until this point. In the future, that may change. So let's say the best case scenario that the industrialization process is still going on but a slower pace. Say the contribution is coming down from 60% to, say, 40%, right? You need something else that would maintain this 30% of the productivity contribution to GDP growth. Maybe technology, maybe entrepreneurship. So even in the best case scenario, you have this 30% contribution from productivity. Remember, the other 70% is not because of that. The other 70% is because of massive investments and labor participation. China is entering into an aging society, so the labor participation rate is only going to come down rather than going up, right? Investment is already 50% of the GDP, right? What does that mean, 50% of the GDP? 50% of the GDP is the highest ratio of any countries that we know of during the peacetime, right? So you can't, you know, there's just that much you can do when you are already, if you're at the top of a mountain, the only way to go is to go down, right? And so all this hope on entrepreneurship and technology, I think that's going to help you, but it's not going to return you to the 10% growth. I'm not making the argument that we need to return to the 10% growth. That's a slightly separate argument. You know, I think 7%, 6%, it's entirely healthy, provided that the income distribution is a healthy one, provided that the personal income, household income growth is healthy, right? So as long as you satisfy those conditions, you actually don't need the 10% growth. I think the reason why there was a perceived need that the country needed 10% growth is because of the lopsided income distribution, right? So if you don't have 10% growth, then the ordinary people don't even get, you know, 5% growth or something like that, right? Under the current system, when you have state-owned enterprises monopolizing all these service provisions, charging very high prices to the rest of the society, land takings and all of that. But once you change that, the growth rate may come down, but the household income growth can either maintain at, say, 5% growth rate or maybe even accelerate. Then there's no problem, right? Let's be very clear. Majority of the countries in the world manage to maintain stability and peace with 3% growth, 4% growth, 5% growth, 2% growth. The political stability argument doesn't depend on the country growing at 10%. I agree, under the current distributional system, you need 10%. But if we change the distributional system, actually you don't need 10%, 5%, 6%. That's good for the global environment. That's good for the health of the Chinese people. It's going to reduce pollution. And it's going to alleviate demands for energy. So I see that as the path.
We're going to take three more questions, and then we'll leave it for informal chat after that. We'll start here.
Hi, I work with a consulting firm that help Chinese company to invest FDI in US and help the Chinese industrial park to bring in foreign FDI. And I have a question for Professor Liu. And do you think the Chinese way to promote innovation can coexist with the traditional manufacturing industry? Because as far as I observe, the way the Chinese government promote innovation is changing their favor from providing stimulus policy to the traditional industry and favoring to the new technology or internet industry, which is lead to many factory closing down in Guangdong or Dongguan. And I would like to know that, do you think the way this kind of damage to traditional manufacturing industry will hurt the Chinese economy before the innovation become the new backbone of the Chinese economy? Thank you.
Basically, I don't think to facilitate the innovation in the industries has any conflict with the maintaining manufacturing industry in China. Basically, China still needs manufacturing industry, definitely, because we have the largest population. Even in the future, we are the second largest population country, but still we need it. Manufacturing. We have to serve the clothing, foods, and everything by ourselves. I don't think though China can rely on the import of such a consumer goods from any other countries. However, we have to upgrade our manufacturing system. Otherwise, we lose our competitiveness and also efficiency, right? So that's what we should do. Now, when we talk about innovation, it's not only about the new business model on the new platform online. It's really kind of a misunderstanding. When we talk about innovation, we also have to invest huge money to upgrade our current manufacturing system. That's not only for the Chinese market, but also in the long run, I believe when the European market, other countries' market, bounce back, we still have to export our products. But we can not only compete in the cheapest consumer goods market, but also have to compete in the good quality consumer goods market. Yes, you're right. When I visited the United States during the last 2-3 years, I could see in the supermarkets, in the department stores, you believe me, 10 years ago, more than 7% are made in China. But now, probably only 30, or probably maximum 50%. United States, import from anywhere, right? Because it's a lower cost and a lower price. So I believe, China needs the more, much better quality products, and also the foreign markets also want us to provide a much, good quality products with some kind of new technology or advanced technology. So innovation, basically, I think have to change the whole, the structure, and also the quality of the manufacturing in China. At the same time, I think if we want to, not only the manufacturing, the whole industry, whole economy should have some kind of competitiveness. We have to rely on the innovation. The innovation of the technology can not only provide such a momentum for the manufacturing industries to further develop, but also to support service industries, definitely. In China, we are talking about supply chain, global sourcing, financial industry. Every industry needs the innovation of technology. So that's the consensus we already have in China. That's a good thing. At the most advanced level, we have to compete with the United States or Europe, for example, for biotechnology, for genome, you know, for the new material. You know, we wanted to compete with any country to pursue the most advanced technology to explore the new industries, green energy, for example. So that's the all-around competition. So we, in I believe in next 10 years, if we're longer, 20 years, we must also have to compete with any country, not only with the, such a Southeast countries or the South American countries, but also with the North America, Europe. You know, we are forced to compete. Not only we have such an intention to compete; otherwise, we cannot survive when we have such a large scale. Right? So that's the you know, the basic point I have.
Thank you. We have just a few minutes left, so I'm going to ask for quick answers, quick responses, and then hopefully we can have time for discussion afterwards. Please go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Professor Holton, a member of SCC. Just a quick question. You know, all the Innovation Society is mainly directed to Dr. Liu, as you have a necessary factor, it's a top-notch research university, and they help to drive, you know, to the innovation. Recently, you know, I just read a few days ago the Wall Street Journal. They say that the Tsinghua University, the engineering school top, the MIT, is now ranked the first in the world. And they say it's a quote from a U.S. News and World Report. Both have very strong Republican leanings. I don't know what's the implication. But I thought, well, how do you, what you comment on that? I mean, well, that's the, well, we already have the best. You know, recently, Chinese government did invest a lot on the advanced education studies and research. But I don't know, do you see there's a real result out of that? And also combined with what I just said about Tsinghua University, does it portend that China will be a very innovative, given that the great education it is providing for its young people right now?
I'm not from Tsinghua, so I don't have any good, you know, the position to comment on that. You know. But, you know, Professor Wang is from MIT. Okay, so basically, you know, I think, though, it's occasionally we have such a good, you know, ranking in the global ranking system. It's good, you know, but no, I don't think the whole country already is ready to be innovative enough country. So I cannot give the comment on the such a ranking about Tsinghua number one in the engineering. But you know, I know in China, the central government wants to have such a, you know, leading universities, you know, global leading universities. So they invest huge money in a couple of, you know, universities in Beijing. Then we have the best of best people, the most talented people. We have the unlimited resources, I mean money. So it's possible to, within a very short term, the ranking could be very good and very high, right? But so what? Why? Only two or three universities or colleges could be ranked so high. But we have to support such a big economy, such a large population, right? So it's not enough. When we can have among the top 10, not top 10, top 100, we can, Chinese universities can have 30 to be ranked, that will be, you know, good enough. So that's my, you know, kind of the reminding you to think of how we can look at such a ranking. So we, our programs, my school's programs also are ranked by Financial Times and very good, you know, but only full time, it's not enough, good enough. So I think that when we talk about innovation, it's about whole country. So that's what I want to share with you.
So Professor Huang, I'm interested in your view on this.
Yeah, so
there's no question that Tsinghua is a formidable university, rapidly rising in production of knowledge, research, teaching. There's no question. I don't want to say, you know, whether it is better than MIT or MIT is better than Tsinghua, but let me give you some statistics about MIT. 80 Nobel Prize winners. Yeah, you don't get 80 that easily. There's a study by Kauffman Foundation in 2010 that tabulated the revenues of all MIT-related technology-based, science-based companies. If you add up the sales revenue of these companies, it is equivalent to the 11th largest GDP of the world. Okay, So I think MIT still has a fighting chance to be considered as a, you know, fairly good school. Yeah.
We have time for one more question. I hope it's a competitive one. Yeah.
Per Liljas from the Swedish newspaper Svenska Dagbladet. I'm just curious about all of the hopes that are being placed now on the tech industry and the Internet Plus and so on. You were talking before about the lack of investments into R&D, but I believe giants such as Huawei, they're putting a lot of money into this. What power do they have to influence the whole sector and kind of lead the way, and what is their role?
You're right. No, I mentioned in the last 30 years, we didn't have a lot of cases. Huawei is only probably one of the limited number of exceptions, probably only one even. You know, another one is, I forgot the name, it's a microwave, you know, manufacturing company. Also, they invest a huge money, you know. On one side, they, you know, export and larger scale, but on the other side, they invest huge money in innovation. So also very successful. But currently, at this moment, though, they also face a lot of challenges or problems. But Huawei still is, you know, surviving very well. Yes, you're right. So we should use this case to educate people. Even you start from very small, no technology, but still you have a chance, but very risky. It's really about entrepreneurship. It's really about a vision, about, you know, brevity and also intelligence. Huawei is really kind of a unique case. We really need 100, even 1,000 such Huawei cases, then China can be the country of innovation. But so far, that's why I said that we start from very beginning, because we only have Huawei. I think, though, I can tell you, at Fudan, my alumnus who actually graduated from my school, who also was the member of the standing committee of bureau, political bureau, Mr. Li Nanqing, set up a Fudan Management Premium Foundation, and we give the award to Huawei's CEO, Ren Zhengfei, you know, because we believe, you know, such a figure is a good, you know, example of innovation, of entrepreneurship. So, but unfortunately, so far central government, I'm not sure, you know, cares about such a case enough or not, you know. Still, we focus on probably the other, they believe, you know, important things. So we really need more Ren Zhengfei than Ma Yun or the other people. Ma Yun also is a hero. Alibaba is a very good, you know, example of innovation of business model, but it's not, you know, the innovation of technology. And but Ma Yun, I should say, Ma Yun is the winner of this year. We also need Ma Yun, but, you know, personally, comparatively, I think China needs more Ren Zhengfei if we want to really develop this country to be the innovation country. So that's my view.
Professors, we've just gone past 5 o'clock. I'd like to thank both of you very much for sharing your thoughts, time, and ideas. We will be here for another half an hour if you'd like to have a coffee and have some informal chat. Again, thank you very much for coming. We've really enjoyed the time.
Mostly loading rather than...